Studies have shown that the farm soil we get our vegetables from is dead, meaning it is depleted of minerals. Sulfur is a mineral. Sulfur has been depleted from the soil, which means most people have been depleted of sulfur. Sulfur has been found to transport oxygen throughout the body. You need oxygen. You need organic sulfur. American Voice Radio Network has organic sulfur. Go to AmericanVoiceRadio.com and then to the Superstore to order your organic sulfur. It's your choice. Do you want to feel better or not? Don't forget to tune in to the Sulfur Hour Plus One on AmericanVoiceRadio.com, Thursdays, 6 p.m. Pacific.
Job stress, financial obligations, or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I am sorry for the late startup today. You're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, and James Corbett of The Corbett Report will be joining you for the second and third segments of the program today. And today is Thursday, November 5th, 2015. I am pleased to have Rob West, Senior Financial Strategist for RME Advisors. He's going to be joining me today. But let's get to the market report first. That'll give Frank a little bit of time to get him on the line for me. So let's go ahead and get started. We have gold down 450 today at 1104. Silver was down 10 cents today at 1507. Platinum is down 3 at 954. And we have palladium down 23 at 609. The USDX today, of course, was stronger once again, nearly hitting the 98. number 97.99, up 0.12. Crude oil was down 102 at 45.30. A little bit of pressure on the markets today, nothing significant yet. But we have the Dow, unless they reversed it in the last minute. They tried to reverse it in the last few minutes of trade. The Dow was down 4, 17,863. NASDAQ was down 14 at 51.27. The S&P was down 2 at 2,099. 10-year yield, 0.01 to the upside at 2.24%. And the euro is up 0.13 at 109. Asian markets fairly unchanged in overnight trading. And we had a little bit of a technical problem getting started, but I do believe we have Rob West on the line with me now. Good afternoon, Rob.
Hi, Melody. How are you on the East Coast?
It's the East Coast. It is the East Coast. You have a little more, you live in a more jolly state, Colorado. It's jolly now.
Well, there's a lot of things going on. The weather's changing a little bit, and so, it's all pretty interesting.
Well, I just wanted to mention, they released the trade agreement, all, I don't know how many pages, 30 chapters and thousands of pages of the trade agreement that was passed. And 30 chapters, 5,000 plus pages. There's so much confusion on this trade deal. So if folks out there don't have anything to read, they can read the Obama trade agreement, the TPP. Those details were released, so we'll have to filter through those. But also, Rob, I think the only reason they didn't renew the Export-Import Bank in July, that they didn't renew the charter, was because of the debt, was because of the budget. Now that that has been passed, we have a budget that's been passed for 2 years. We have a debt ceiling that basically was eliminated. And now they're going to try and push through the and renew the charter. And so that is back on. They're going to try to attach the Export-Import Bank charter to the funding highway programs. And the highway measure went through the House today with that provision to reauthorize the bank. And we know the Export-Import Bank helps overseas buyers get financing to purchase U.S. exports. So it enjoys widespread support. And I think the only reason you had some of the congressmen or the Republicans not like this was they're going to approve it anyway. So that's what I think happened. The charter expired on June 30th, and it's been unable to get approving new financing applications since then. So
it's really hard for the average person to follow what's in the regular mainstream news anyway, but I know how much you and Al read into things as well. It's a lot more in depth, and in the entire fractional reserve banking system is a mystery, and I'm just watching day by day, as everyone else is, to see more signs of something taking traction and starting to make sense, and then, or maybe they might go the other direction. You got to be prepared for something else. So I understand what you're saying.
Well, you had mentioned prior to, we spoke earlier today about the, I think this is what you were explaining to me, the investment world about 11, was it, I don't know how many trillions of dollars that there's not enough money to cover it. Would you like to go a little bit more into detail on that? Explain that to the listeners?
Well, some information that I think is reliable indicates that our annual consumer spending is $11.2 trillion. And so that means, what we do here in Colorado, what you do, everybody, buying and selling, gasoline, groceries. So we got $11.2 trillion floating around but most of it is floating around believing that your credit card is going to be honored and cleared, and that all your payments are eventually going to be settled up. But the reality appears to be that there's about a 9-to-1 or 10-to-1 ratio of things continuing to move through the economy that's never settled up. It's always one person's credit being accepted because someone else's credit paid it off. And so, in other words, the real dollars available, if we can pull them out of our wallets and purses and count them up, there's like $1.2 trillion in real dollars to settle up $11.2 trillion in transactions. So the scary thing could be, what if all of a sudden no one has the belief in the credit system and they start looking to get paid off in something real? And in my analogy, I'm continuing to use Federal Reserve notes, and there's just not enough of them to go around physically. And I think it makes a lot of sense to gauge that type of reality with discount gold and silver trading, because everyone knows for centuries the real money has actually been gold and silver, not the paper money. So if we have a situation like that that would occur, then to worry about the prices of goods and services and inflation, I think, would be a secondary emergency. The primary emergency would be it would very suddenly disrupt all commerce, and over the medium and longer term, jobs would be lost, shopping couldn't continue, and we'd have a society without any financial guidance system for a while. So it could be a real problem, and that's why you're mentioning the banking system, and then the follow-up with the fractional reserve banking, which basically, for new listeners, it would be when money or even credit applications are deposited with a bank, they're typically leveraged up 7 times more in value to give that bank more balance sheet fractional reserve currency to loan out for something else. And it's just really difficult to imagine a system like that going on for the 100 years that the Federal Reserve has been here. It just, it really wasn't true that the emperor had no clothes. He really had them on, but they were made out of such chic material it appears that there were no clothes at all. We might be looking through that chic and sheer clothing right now. Here's what I'm saying.
I was talking to a gentleman yesterday, and he was telling me about his father, that he was investing in gold and silver for 30 to 40 years, and thinking that, the system couldn't last, that they continue to push the envelope to all of these extremes where it is sort of mind-boggling, but yet it's mind-boggling because we really don't know all the tools that are available to them. That to us, it's mind-boggling, but yet they have had all these ways to continue. But yet they're pushing us to the brink. And let me ask you a question. What do you personally think could be the catalyst? I mean, everybody is trying to, they pick this, they get in this camp, they get in that camp. I'm in the camp of just the fiat currency. I mean, we knew that once that began, there was going to be an end. And I think we're close to the end, just like you mentioned. You can't, you build a house with debt, it's going to fall with debt. So that's where I think the main crisis is going to appear, and it could be instigated by some sort of an outside event that we don't know is coming. Do you have a personal thought as far as...
Well, I think earlier we were mentioning a number of different research services that you and I both know about, and if we had, each one of them had a flashlight, it's all pointing in the same direction, but they're pointing there for different reasons. And so what the catalyst could be, I don't know if there would be anyone in particular, but one of the scarier ones would be a false flag disruption of some kind that would put something believable in front of the regular public, and that could tip off other concerns about can you really pay back your credit balances, and maybe going down that path that there's not enough dollars. I mean, if there's not enough dollars go around to settle up what's been traded in goods and services, where do you think gold stands on that? I mean, there's much less gold than there are dollars. And when I heard about that $1.2 trillion in the dollars to back up over $11 trillion in trading in credit, it's also indicated that more than half of the physical U.S. dollars are overseas. And there's still a lot of folks that's over 50 and over 60 that have U.S. dollars stuffed in the mattress, and they're just not circulated. So, this situation could occur where, I think the average person probably could not go 3 to 5 days without stopping at the grocery or getting gasoline. You know, there's just no preparation. And you should see the building that's going on out here in Colorado and the condominiums. A friend of mine recently bought an $89,000 condo in Aurora, Colorado. And you walk up 16 steps that's outdoors. You walk in to the living room, which was small, a small place for a kitchenette table and a small place for a stove and a bedroom and a bathroom. That's it. No washer, dryer, no nothing for $89,000, you know? Mm. And I'm thinking, wow. So things are pretty much inflated out here for a lot of reasons, and some of it might due to the popularity of the new cigarettes out here, so I don't know.
Possibly. But you know what? For a long time, there's been no affordable housing in this country, and our infrastructure is just decaying. We don't have mass transit like we should have. And, I mean, this country has just been so neglected for how many years, and all the money that was there has been used for wars and has been used to make sure that Wall Street continues and these multinational corporations continue, all these world governments continue and so forth, and yet here we are just left, we're just decaying. And it's you know, I don't know if people really realize it, whether they understand it, and but yeah, there's been no one day there's going to be affordable housing, but I'm sure it's not the housing that most people will appreciate.
Yeah, well, there's a number of folks that are in my age group in the young 60s, and they're anticipating their kids having to move home in the next few years, and. You know, the cost of living and the raising a family of two kids, and with when we hear the job rates and you know how everything is fudged a little bit between employment numbers and all that, well, those folks working the 30 hours a week and less at McDonald's really shouldn't be counted in the employment numbers the way it seemed to be intended. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just not that much income going around, much less disposable income. Mm-hmm. And, after the tax gets taken out and the basic necessities get paid for, usually that's why so many people got used to operating on $5,000 or $10,000 or $15,000 over their annual income, because they were invited to float it on credit cards.
Yeah.
And so it was, the bankers knew there was a scientific method for them to raise your standard of living by using their inflated cost of credit. And like I think we've mentioned in the past, 10 years ago in 2005, the Chapter 7 bankruptcy rules
were
modified to make it more difficult to file for a complete discharge. And things were doing really well then. Wonder why that happened then.
Yeah. I don't want to, we're out of time. 20 minutes goes by quick, and we had a little trouble connecting at the top of the hour. I had wanted to talk just a little bit about the LIBOR rate scandal. You had two British ex-bankers, but we're going to have to save that for another time. If you could really quick give out any of your contact information so we can get to break. Thank you for joining me, Rob.
Thank you, Melody.
Yeah. Go ahead and give your contact real quick.
Yeah, rmeadvisors.com, Rocky Mountain Educational Advisors.com, our website. Best way to reach me is communicate through there, and that'll do fine.
All righty. We'll spend a little more time on that the next time you join me. Thank you, folks. Stay tuned. Alfred and James will be here.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Frank, our producer, who is responsible for any misstatements I make, any of the technical problems, anything that goes wrong here, Frank is the one who gets blamed. And I was just going to say, apparently, maybe James Corbett was not here, and Frank is speculating that the time change caught him by surprise, and therefore he wasn't available, but I just find out James is here. Hello, James, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Yes, I was mixed up by the time change, but I'm here. I made it. It's okay.
Good. James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. James is talking to us from Japan. We're going to talk about various events in geopolitics and see if James can shed a little light on what's going on. For example, here's an article from CBS. So satellite detected heat flash at time Russian jetliner went down. That's the headline. Mystery and confusion surround the final moments of the Russian jetliner that plummeted suddenly from high altitude to the Egyptian desert, killing 224 people aboard. The airline Monday ruled out pilot error or technical fault, but Russian aviation officials dismissed those comments as premature. They claim apparently they're keeping an open mind, but U.S. national security correspondent reports that a U.S. infrared satellite detected a heat flash over the Sinai at the time the Russian plane went down, indicating an explosion may have taken the plane down. Whether it was hit by a missile, by a bomb on the plane, whether an internal defect in the fuel tanks caused a wing to explode or something like that remains to be seen. I'm curious. What do you think caused the Russian airplane to go down over the Sinai Desert? Do you have an opinion on that yet, James, or is it too early to say?
I haven't even been following the investigation, so I wouldn't even have an informed opinion, but I do know that the debris was spread over 9 kilometers, which means the plane absolutely did break up in midair, which generally doesn't happen unless there's some sort of explosive decompression type event. And, I guess it could be a technical fault of the plane, but that tends to be a disaster that is man-made in one way or another.
You know that ISIS has, people who claim to speak for ISIS claim that they brought the plane down. Other people say the plane was at 30,000 feet altitude. They don't believe ISIS has any missiles that can reach 30,000 feet. Point one, so they don't think ISIS did it. They're taking credit where they did not. They were not truly responsible. But what do you think about ISIS claiming credit for knocking this plane down? Is that a dumb idea? Is that going to inspire Russia to say, all right, we're going to fix you. Watch and see what happens in Syria now.
Well, I mean, the other question is it's not that ISIS was officially the Islamic State issued some official proclamation. This was just some group that is associated with ISIS in some way that's
they
there.
They claim
in,
to be associated.
Egypt. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, I mean, take it for what it's worth, which is not much. But, of course, I mean, any terrorist group loves to proclaim that they were responsible for this or that because it brings attention to their group. That's the entire point of such things. And, I think we just have to take it all with a grain of salt until we learn more. But I think either way, I don't think this is going to change anything geopolitically. The only thing that it might change is domestic opinion in Russia to further solidify the Russian people's sense that Russia is fighting terrorists. So now terrorists are fighting back in that kind of war on terror narrative.
Well, then they can use maybe the same script we had.
Well, they've already been using it. In fact, that's exactly why Russia and Putin were tacitly, at least not if not behind, at least sort of passively allowing the Bush regime in the early days after 9/11 to run wanton over what was traditionally seen more as Moscow's territory in Afghanistan and elsewhere, because they had their own backyard terrorism problem they were dealing with the Chechens. So it was a convenient narrative for Putin as much as it was for Bush.
And shouldn't there be a law against having people writing the same narratives for other countries? Shouldn't you get a copyright on a narrative? If I invent a new narrative, do I get a copyright on it so the other countries can't use the same? Or is this something that's been going back thousands of years?
Well, yeah, I mean, ultimately. But that brings to mind that Australian politician a few years ago who stole a speech from, I can't remember which movie, but some Hollywood movie. He just stole the speech literally line for line, word for word, and just swapped out names.
It's a tribute to the intelligence that is so manifest in our politicians around the world. They just say it, copy it. I don't know if they understand it. Maybe even be in a foreign language. They just read the speech. Here's another one, another probably uncredible headline. Russian source, Saudi intelligence responsible for airline bomb. Good source that's blaming the Saudis. The intelligence source, solidly named Saudi Arabia, as responsible for the bombing, which killed 244. Egyptian intelligence was fully complicit in the terror act. The source stated half the Egyptians work for Israel, the other half for Saudi Arabia anyway. Egypt has no security service, only paid foreign spies. More hyperbole, or is there any truth to that?
Well, I mean, again, I think there's two different ways to look at this. There's the 2D narrative and the 3D narrative, as I like to say on the geopolitical chessboard. On the 2D narrative, if this ultimately is found to be pegged to a bomb or something that went off on board and it was a terrorist act, it will be blamed on terrorists. And as I say, the war on terror narrative neatly covers that. Of course, the 3D narrative says, well, who are the terrorists and who has been funding, training, equipping, supporting them? Everyone knows at this point, it's not even really much of a secret, but everyone knows that Saudi Arabia has been very much behind the radical Wahhabi Sunnists in throughout the region, and of course in Syria, that have been attempting to topple Assad, that Russia is now attempting to bomb. So ultimately, I think Russia and Putin are no fools. They know that the Saudis are the ones behind funding and equipping and training these terrorists, along with their pals, the U.S. and Turkey and Qatar and the other Gulf states. So I think Russia knows that, but I don't think they'll ever play that, or they're not going to play that card at this point anyway, because, again, it threatens to topple the whole war on terror narrative.
I think Russia's also angry. They have at least reason to be upset with Saudi Arabia insofar as Saudis were the first ones to precipitate the decline in the price of oil back about 15, 18 months ago. The Saudis started this, and I've seen at least some sources that say they did so at the insistence of the United States. We persuaded them to start pushing the price lower, and the reason was to get Russia. And in doing so, we've hurt the Russian economy by diminishing the price of crude oil. I'm wondering, do you think the Soviets or the Russians accept that narrative? Do they think that's true? And do they have a grudge against Saudi Arabia? Would they like an opportunity to plant some of their own bombs on Saudi aircraft?
Well, I'm sure that Russian intelligence has at least a better grasp of whether or not that narrative is true. And I think that even if it is true that this was specifically the oil price decline was a weapon that was aimed at Russia, which, I mean, I think there's a number of problems with that theory. I think there might be some partial truth to that. But even if it was completely true, I don't think it's ultimately under control at this point. I don't think this is a controlled crash in oil price, because I think now even Saudi Arabia is starting to feel the pinch. They are actually starting to cut back on their budget. So I think whatever beast has been unleashed, I don't think it's a controlled beast. So I don't think this was 100% just a weapon to be used against Russia, but certainly Russia is feeling the pinch from it. And it's not hard to identify one of the nations that has been controlling oil more or less directly for decades now, and that is Saudi Arabia. So I think there's obviously an interesting relationship that takes place between Russia and Saudi Arabia that is sometimes fraught with difficulties, and this may be a sign that another difficulty is coming down along the road.
Well, they're the number one and two producers of petroleum products in the world, isn't that correct?
Off the top of my head, I believe that's true, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're the one and two. And some say Russia's producing even, say Russia's the biggest producer, some say Saudi's. Hard to say, but apparently there's not much doubt that they are one and two, at least up until the time Iran comes back online. I don't know where Iran will fit in. But
if I recall correctly, I believe Russia has twice this year overtaken Saudi Arabia, off the top of my head.
All right. Well, they're close. All right, one and one. So there's a natural competition there. And one of the things, I saw a report from Gerald Celente. He was interviewed recently. Can't remember who interviewed him, but in the they talked about alternative energy. And Celente is saying, look, there are going to be energy breakthroughs in things like zero-point energy and hydrogen energy and thorium. And he anticipates these are coming in the near future. And they are going to completely disrupt the existing fossil fuel energy market. Now, if that happens, if he's right, and he's saying this is happening, these he thinks, he didn't give a timetable, but I had the impression he's talking about 3 years, 5 years before we see a major breakthrough within no later than that. I had that impression. He didn't say that, but that was the impression I had from the article. How is this going to affect, he thinks, fossil fuels are on the way out. And he says the prices are down now, and the supply is so abundant, and the demand is so low. Prices aren't going back up. How is that going to affect the value of the petrodollar? Number one, how is it affected if the price of oil is going down? That's point one. And point two, if we're going to lose the petroleum industry as a major source of energy in the world, what's going to happen to any petrocurrency? What are they going to do? How is this going to, you know, is a petrodollar going to survive this in any way?
Well, on the first point, I mean, it just is sheerly, just on its face, a decline in the price of oil necessarily going to hurt the petrodollar? Not necessarily, because the decline in oil price, if it is related as it seems to be at this point in time to a general global economic slowdown, means there's less overall economic activity. So it could be that oil prices relative to overall economic activity are maintaining a roughly similar ratio, and in that case, it's supports the petrodollar at the same rate that it was supporting it before, if not by the same total number. So there's a number of things going on there that there's econometrics to take into account that I think are probably beyond the ken of either of us to fully articulate. But at any rate, it's not.
I didn't ask you to articulate. We're trying to opinionate. But I'm doing opinionate, not articulate. If you get my drift here.
Yes. No. But the point is taken that certainly the petrodollar is in jeopardy in from a number of different angles. One of which is, as I've talked about in recent years, this seeming, if not severing, at least a destabilization of the Saudi-U.S. relationship that is the backbone of the petrodollar, which, let's remind ourselves, is basically just the recycling of U.S. dollars back through U.S. treasuries into the U.S. banking system from Saudi Arabia and others who exchange oil on their oil versus in U.S. dollars, so that everyone needs to get U.S. dollars, so there's always a demand for U.S. dollars, and those dollars are recycled back into the U.S. debt. That's the way the system has been supported for 30, 40 years now, and that is coming to an end, as we all understand, I think. I don't think that's really controversial at this point. At least the relationship as it has existed is coming to an end. Now, on the point of disruptive technologies, absolutely there are. I think we'd have to be naive to believe that the internal combustion engine really is the pinnacle of all, you know, transportation technology that has been invented in the history of humanity or ever will be. Clearly, I mean, in the last 100 years or so, surely there has been disruptive technologies that could have succeeded that if there had been the proper access to market for people with those ideas. And as we've seen with things like who killed the electric car and other things from decades and decades ago, people who had different ideas about how to organize our infrastructure and transportation and all of these ideas based on different technologies were sometimes we're always taken out of the picture, sometimes quite literally by being killed in various quote-unquote accidents. And so I think we have to look at the question of whether a disruptive technology can really come to market in the current context and climate where the oligarchs, I mean, continue to rule over much of society with their iron fist. And there's a lot of history that has to be articulated there to really flesh that narrative out. But I will say that if I'm being my most cynical, I will say that the monopolists who enjoy their oil monopoly will not give that up easily, but they will, I think, at some point have to give that up for a new technology, a new paradigm, but they will make sure to try to monopolize that next paradigm, whatever it is. The truly disruptive technology, zero-point energy or cold fusion or whatever it may be, I'm sure will be suppressed with all the might that the oligarchs can bring to bear.
I knew a man, Terry Lofton, back in the 1990s, and he was interested in the study of law, and he'd drive down to SMU Law Library where they were selling off all their old books, and I helped him pack a pickup truck, loaded the entire bed of the pickup truck with old law books. He was buying them for a buck a piece, right? He took a whole, you know, nobody could ever read that, but he had them, and he was in the habit of collecting this stuff. He's passed on now, but Terry, at one point, picked up an operations manual for the Federal Reserve. He, in the estate sale, some wealthy individual, it was a three-ring, three-volume set of binders. And if you wanted to see it, you could go find the same manual today, or it would have been amended by now. But you could get there
You can go to the Federal Reserve, tell them I'd like to make an appointment, see it, and they'll let you look at it for a half hour, but you can't take any notes, can't take any copying equipment. And if you'd like to see it again, you can come back in 6 months or a year. Lofton got a three-volume set of these, and he read through the volume. I did not read it, all right? But I have no doubt. I believe he was telling the truth. One of the big surprises is Federal Reserve policy was not to loan any money to anything other than nuclear power, oil power, petroleum power, and coal power. They would not lend money to solar energy. Any alternative energy, they used their influence to see that loans were not made available. In that regard, they controlled energy policy in the United States by simply saying, you people aren't going to get any money. I find that to be fascinating. I wonder if they're still doing it today, or if, because the alternative energy is blossoming, it's blooming. Have the Fed relented? Are they going to give them a fair shake? I give alternative energy a fair shake, or try to still squelch it? You seem to think they're going to try to squelch it. They'll continue to do so. Why don't we take a break for some commercials? And if you want to answer to that or make further comment, why don't you do that when we get back from our next little bout of commercials. I'm Alfred Attisk here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Please stay tuned.
Make the aspirin mistake. Aspirin was discovered by mistake during World War II and suppresses your immune system and prevents blood clotting. Don't expose your body to risk when you can use a natural inflammation and pain reliever called Extra Strength Pain Relief by Apothecary Herbs. Discover the power this formula has with salicin to enter the system in 60 seconds to work hard and relieve pain for 12 hours. Whether it's arthritis, sports injury, or flu, you can relieve aches, pain, and swelling with our Extra Strength Pain Relief formula. Call Apothecary Herbs now, toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at the 3Ws.thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Attisk here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com, speaking about issues involving international politics and economics and so on. Did you have anything else you wanted to add relative to the Federal Reserve and the oligarchs' influence on energy policy?
Well, no. I think it's just a good illustration of how the banking system can be used mm-hmm. to steer society in various ways, and I think that's why it's absolutely no surprise that the Rockefeller dynasty, after having consolidated their monopoly over oil back in the late 19th century, parlayed that into, of course, their philanthropic, quote-unquote, work in the early 20th century, directing, for example, the medical industry, as I've talked about in a podcast on Rockefeller medicine, and shaping the type of what we even think of at, when we think of the word medicine, which is actually largely based on petroleum products, no surprise there, or agriculture with the Green Revolution, or, of course, energy and the energy sector in general. And, of course, they parlayed that influence into getting into the banking sector with, of course, David Rockefeller becoming head of Citibank and piloting that for many years. So I think that that story, basically, I mean, you have the Rockefeller dynasty is the story of the United States of the past century and a half in a nutshell. And I think that's not a good story, but it's an instructive one, and perhaps shows us that at least shows us where the power really is, and yeah. And how and where it should be resisted. And on that note, what is coming up in just a few weeks, of course, it's the next COP, the Conference of the Parties of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in Paris, which, of course, is largely supported by the Rockefellers and Rothschilds and other names that will be familiar to listeners. And they're about to start things like creating a UN climate tribunal, an international body to rule on whether countries are breaking their climate commitments, etc. So there's some pretty scary stuff coming down the road.
How are they going to enforce? I mean, it's not as if the UN can put it, you know, you do as we say or we're going to bomb you. They don't have the resources. It would be clearly just an advisory decision at this time, it seems to me. It might lay the foundation for more power in the future, maybe a bad precedent, but at least for short term, how do they enforce their decisions?
Well, let's look at the actual text itself, and let's see if I can find it. A process compliance mechanism committee, including a committee as a standing subsidiary body under the CMA, is hereby established to promote compliance by developed countries' parties and facilitate implementation by developing country parties through provision of adequate financial resources, blah, blah, blah. I mean, a lot of legalese, but you can actually go to the draft text that they are working on for this conference. It is at unfcc.int. I have a link to it in my latest article on CorbettReport.com. And they do have the at least the idea for creating a compliance mechanism, including the tribunal, which will rule on what will happen, and then there's going to be a facilitative mechanism, which will facilitate implementation by developing countries to enhance action on mitigation, adaptation, blah blah blah. The mechanism shall be facilitative, non-punitive, non-adversarial, and non-judicial.
Okay.
I have no idea what that means. Of course,
unfortunately,
none of the details are here. So.
In the beginning of what you read, I understood one phrase to indicate they were going to control the availability of credit. All right, which kind of surprises me. I don't understand the UN by itself to be in control of how much money is available to different nations. I know they give grants, but it suggests that they are going to unite with the Bank of International Settlements or the IMF, and they're going to say, okay, you're not maintaining your climate control obligations, so we're going to cut your monetary stipend this year by 30%.
Well, actually, it's funny that you mention that, because that is actually an idea for that type of banking mechanism, that the institution of that, that's been kicking around for at least 2.5 decades now. And there was a recording that was snuck out of the Fourth Wilderness Conference that was held, I believe, in Denver, Colorado. I believe it was in the late 1980s. And there's actually a video of the person who got that recording, and he made a documentary about it. And it includes, I can't remember which member of the Rothschild clan, but one of them giving a speech at that conference talking about the establishment of a World Bank type, not the World Bank, but a World Bank organization that would play that role of mm-hmm. being sort of the international overseer of this sustainable development mechanism, or whatever they want to call it. And you're right, in that text that I was reading, it was talking about facilitating implementation by the countries through provision of adequate financial resources and transfer of technology. So yes, they're at least trying, they at least want to aspirationally control some mechanism that will direct resources around the planet from this country to this country under terms litigated apparently by the new UN International Tribunal of Climate Justice. What could go wrong?
Yeah, we've got an example of this. that we've been that we've watched for most of this past year. And we here's an article dealing with the subject at Zero Hedge. The headline is, after 6 years of austerity, 36% of Greeks in poverty. Thousands of austerity measures, dramatic cuts in incomes, incredible hikes in taxes, 5.5 years in deep recession, 3 bailout agreements, and where do the Greeks stand now? On top of the Eurozone when it comes to poverty. More than 1 out of 3 Greeks, that is 36% of the Greek population, is at risk of poverty and social exclusion, the highest rate within the Eurozone. Point. They've been, the whole Greek drama has been about they can't pay their bills. And the creditors have been trying to keep them in a position where they keep trying to pay their bills. And if you won't pay your bills, we won't give you any more money. This is an example of what we're talking about, where people in positions of power, essentially creditors, say, listen, we're going to control your country. You're going to have to sell off some of your assets. You're going to have to take orders from us. What is their objective? The creditors, what is the creditors' objective in relation to Greece? Do they really think they're going to be paid, or are they looking for a pound of flesh?
Well, in Greece specifically, I think it's the pound of flesh. I think it's more about leveraging power and control over the Greek government than it is about getting that money in particular, although I think that's part of it, and certainly certain members and parties would be interested simply in the monetary obligation. But I think the overall agenda is one to increase the control and leverage of the European Union and the ECB in particular over Greece. And I think that's what this has all been aimed at. And that's, in fact, really the conclusion that parliamentary committee in Greece that was looking into the problem of the debt and found it to be an odious debt, what they were saying is that this has been entered into in bad faith on the part of the creditors, with them fully expecting that this would, and knowing that this would be unpayable in the long run. So this is, again, a type of engineered collapse specifically to get the Greek government under the thumb of the ECB.
Is this a dangerous strategy? Because if 36% have been put into poverty for 6 years now, are they going to become angry enough to try to overthrow the existing government? And if they does this defeat the creditors'
objectives? I see what you're
saying.
It's interesting. So the dangerous side of it is danger to the existing structure. So the people who are puppeteering this, they might end up getting overthrown because of this. Unfortunately, I think that so many of the people at the bottom rung of that economic ladder probably don't really see the bigger picture. They just see their politicians in Greece, and they identify their problems with those politicians. So there may be some kickback and rioting and things that might affect perhaps the sitting Greek government, but is anyone going to go and protest the ECB? I mean, that's much less likely, because again, if people are directed in the wrong direction, then let them riot. I don't think the people at the higher levels really care about that.
All right, there was had another question, skipped my mind. Let's move on to Germany. Here's a headline from Russia Today. Migrant crisis pushing Germany towards anarchy and civil war. Is that too extreme? It says Germany is now somewhere at the edge of anarchy and sliding towards civil war, or to become a banana republic without any government, says Hans-Jörg Müller of the Alternative for Germany party. This goes on. Is he just this hyperbole, or is Germany in some danger because of the influx of Muslim immigrants?
Germany is going to become anarchy without government? Yay! Oh, they mean chaos. Okay, never mind. I thought they meant the actual philosophical meaning. No, yes, I mean, there's clearly huge tensions that are brewing as a result of this, and there's no doubt that this is causing social strain in Europe. I hear from my European listeners on pretty much a daily basis. There are the people who are simply anti-migrant, anti-refugee, whatever you want to say about it. And then there are the other people who see that this is being engineered, and it seems to be being allowed to happen or encouraged to happen, as we talked about last week. But what do you do about it? It is causing genuine tensions, and people are getting genuinely upset about what's happening. So it is one of those things. It is an on-the-ground reality at the moment, and it is polarizing people, and it is causing a resurge in the sort of far right of the European spectrum, and that, I think, is going to start playing out in the polls in coming years. I mean, this is causing a change in European politics. I don't know if it's anarchy and chaos on the streets, but at any rate, it is causing a change, and it is causing social disturbance.
Do you think the average German is directing his anger entirely at the immigrants? Or is he directing his anger at his government that has refused to protect their own national borders and has effectively allowed the immigrants to come in? Who's the villain in this, if there is a villain?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for the average German, obviously, but my sense is that it's a little bit of one, a little bit of the other. I don't think it has to be differentiated, and I don't think most people do. I think they're probably angry at their politicians and angry at the influx of migrants and what's, you know, the way that they're behaving themselves or not behaving themselves. And of course, a lot of that information comes mediated through media. And of course, you're going to have one slant or one side of the media that's only covering the positive stories or things that are, that aren't bad, or covering it from a, you know, that perspective. And then there's going to be the other media that every incident that you know, is a problem is going to be reported as if this is all that's happening right now. So again, I think the polarization is kind of baked into the cake right now. And people are just going to become firmer and firmer in their beliefs that this is either the end of civilization or, you know, this is the new face of European society or something like that.
I don't see how it can be the new face of European society. It may be the new face of whatever society remains, but I don't think you're going to be able to call it European. If you get enough Muslim immigrants in there, its claim to be European is going to be, you know, doubtful. Now, one more here before we run out of time. It's along the same idea. Headline, EU could fall apart within weeks from tens of thousands of migrant invasion. More hyperbole?
Within weeks?
That's what it says. That's the headline. Within weeks.
Well, there you go. I love it when people have predictions that are almost immediately verifiable or falsifiable. So we'll just wait. Just wait a few weeks and we'll revisit that article.
We'll find out for sure if this particular prophet knows what he's talking about or not. What do we got left here? 2 minutes, thereabouts. Hurt by cheap oil. This is from Reuters. Hurt by cheap oil. Saudi government will make water more expensive. They used to, essentially, they subsidized water because it has to be, it's a result of desalinization over in Saudi Arabia. They're going to start charging more for water while they're charging less for oil. This is evidence of what you talked about earlier in the program. We were talking about Saudi Arabia's being hurt by its own plan to knock oil prices down, or its own role in knocking oil prices down. Is there anything, if it's true that the Saudis got this ball bouncing, is there anything the Saudi, you would think, okay, if they stepped on the accelerator, can't they step on the brake? Or have they gone, has something happened where no one's in control? We can't raise oil prices. Is it just out of control and going to fall further?
I don't know if it's completely out of control, but it certainly isn't completely in control. I mean, there's still, I think, levers that that can be pressed, and it still is dependent on things like supply. So if people supply more, then the price will go down. If people supply less, it'll go up. But I don't think that's, I mean, it's not a perfect knob, if you know what I mean. It's not like you can twist it to any point on the dial that you want. You can only start to move it in the direction that you want, or keep it where it is. And that's only if everyone cooperates and acts in the same agenda. But as people have been noting, the OPEC conglomerate has fallen apart. And some people say it's dead. Some people say it's divorced. But at any rate, it seems to be every man pumping for himself at this point, yeah, which is just keeping the price down. So yes, I think that the ability, I mean, the idea that Saudi Arabia has an ultimate control over the oil price is being exposed for a fraud, because they really are hurting from this at this point, and there's no sign that oil is going to be peaking back up in price anytime soon. So we'll have to see that. And on the other part of that, I guess I think that the peak water idea is going to be the sort of resource scare of the 21st century, and I think we're going to start seeing a lot more of that in the headlines in coming years.
I agree. All right, James, thank you very much for your time. Always enjoy talking to you on our Thursday programs. The program will air, it's Wednesday night as I speak. It'll air on Thursday, mañana. I look forward to talking to you again a week from now. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Frank the producer, and everyone who's listening to the program. Good night, folks. I'm Alfred Addis, and this is Financial Survival.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.